go.
Yep.
Okay. Let's send some of these around.
It's the same from last week?
It is the same from last week.
Okay, so I don't need one.
The first one, anyway. The first package today. So what we're going to do is I'm going to give you, if you weren't here, or you don't have it again, you're welcome to it.
So it's still Amud Tzadik or Tzadik Aleph?
I'm going to go to 90B5.
Tzadik
B. We're going to start. Henry? There you go. There you are. Sorry, do you need?
No, thanks.
Okay. Phones off, buzzers off, papers, please.
And the Hebrew is the Tzadik Bet, so you didn't give us Tzadik.
The Hebrew that you have.
We have only Tzadik and Tzadik Aleph.
I have B5.
No, that's in the English.
It's out of order, I think.
Okay, it doesn't matter. If we have
it in B5.
Yes.
I have English.
You have on the back.
Okay, so there is no letters there.
Nachon.
Okay.
Because 180 is what 90B is.
180, okay, so that's Tzadik B.
Okay. So what I want to do is I want to start with kind of the end of this first section of conversation that we started last time, which is about the whole notion of there being an Olam Haba, about the world to come. And we ended last time with the whole notion of this, the Rambam's really proclaiming an explicit belief in a world to come, in a potential resurrection, and what that resurrection potentially, what life would hold. We looked at some secondary sources regarding visions of what that life is in the world to come. And what I want to do is I want to start with a bright on 90B that explores what is really in the end of the first Mishnah, which we skipped over when we studied the first Mishnah together, because we're going to go back now and look at the first Mishnah and look at a little bit of the content of the first Mishnah, look at some of the Gemara on the first Mishnah. But by looking at the Braita on 90B5, and it thinking and the thinking we're going to do about whether or not a person really can be cut off entirely from the world to come, it'll lead us to a source just before we get to the second part of the Mishnah. Okay, so on 90B5. Kitana A. Oh, the Gemara brings up from a discussion that was happening previously a dispute between Tanaim. Tanaim being, again, the rabbis of the Mishnaic era. A Braita teaches the following. Hikaret tikaret. When Scripture states cutting off, for sure it shall be cut off, it means hikaret ba'olam hazeh, tikaret la'olam haba. Divrei Rabbi Akiva. Cutting off from life in this world, and it shall be cut off from life in the world to come. Rabbi Akiva teaches that it can be both. Amarlo Rabbi Yishmael, Balo Kvarne Amara, Et Hashem Hu Megadef V'Nichrita, but don't I have another verse that says, it's Hashem whom he blasphemed, and that soul shall be cut off forever? Blasphemy here is understood by Rashi to be idolatry, Avodah Zarah. V'chi shlosha olamim yesh. Are there then three worlds that Karet might apply to? It's not enough last time that we were talking about this life and the next life. Perhaps in the big mix of the way we see the whole cosmos and infinite time, we're talking about three worlds. Ela v'nichrata ba'olam hazeh. Your verse, nichrata, or that verse, nichrata, that was brought up by Rabbi Yishmael, that should be interpreted as follows. Cut off shall be the soul from the life in this world. Hikaret la'olam haba. cutting off refers to life in the world to come. He karet, ti karet, dibra Torah kilashon b'nei Adam. And as for the double expression, cutting off, it shall be cut off. There's no special significance in this repetition, for the Torah speaks the language of men. So whereas the Braita can hold the possibility that you have this other world, right? Potentially, what is that other world? Let's say that they're striving on having a soul life being interpreted as a world to come, and then maybe a third world is the world of what? Resurrection. And entirely being resurrected, a la the bodily resurrection we thought of in one stream of thought, versus a spiritual type of soul life that is ultimately the problem. Now, there's another way to read the Braita, of course. What's that?
He's saying there aren't three worlds, so why are you interpreting...
Well, the end of the Braita, but the Hava Amina that he puts forward works for me always as a straw man to the possibility of what the Hava Amina is saying. He's saying there's not. But the Gemara, by doing so in its literary function, of having a Braita in which the possibility even comes up, you could say... What's that?
He's inviting the question.
Now, not everybody looks at a Braita that way, Jay, and not everybody looks at a Hava Amina that way, within a Braita. But I would say that the inclusion of the editors to have a Braita with such a question allows me to pose in my mind such a question. Because we're in such a state of talking about two worlds as it is, doesn't seem like a far stretch for me to then think about, wait a minute, am I talking about a world that has three cosmic possibilities in terms of this life and an afterlife and then an after the afterlife?
So perhaps you'd like to just fill in Hava Amina for the rest of us.
So Hava Amina is a straw man, an idea that's put up as one idea or another that's then oftentimes just simply knocked down in terms of the Gemara's rhetoric. It's actually stated in the actual rhetoric of the Talmud, right? Hava, I mean, I might have said, or we might have thought in that sense, or it might be argued that this is the way to understand something, and then it's actually knocked down, caught with a kamashmalan, a technical term that ultimately says, well, that thought only came to teach us the following, or that piece of the argument came only to teach us the following. You might have thought this, that it really referred to a third world. Well, I'll tell you that it really doesn't. So before the whole editorial process of the Gemara, in a Braita, that same possibility exists without all of the scaffold vocabulary.
But the same person who sets up the straw man has to knock it down, or there's two separate voices to play the different roles?
Well, in this case, it's kind of like the teacher of the Braita himself proposes it and knocks it down. Sometimes it's taken from, like, say, a second person's argument about something, and then they're suggesting that you might have thought this, and then that's brought back around in a different way with not necessarily following the same one author. Sounds like it's more dialogical.
No, but it's not Rabbi Ishmael who sets it up here, it's Rabbi Akiva. Same person setting it up was not them. I mean, if what you mean is, well, he's saying we have this verse that covers one situation, and the verse you raised covers another one. You're interpreting it to be two, but I don't view him as being the person introducing the concept so much as it was implicit in what Rabbi Akiva said.
Yeah, that's definitely, you could read it that way as well.
The same person who knocks it down is the person who articulates it.
The person who knocks it down? I think the rabbi suggesting it's not always that.
Right, I know, I just said.
Because sometimes I'm sure the stuff that comes out, I don't know where it comes from. Mm-hmm.
Yeah. So it can be a number of ways.
No, your point's interesting because, of course, just this doesn't need to be here at all. So why is it expressed this way, explained this way?
Right. Okay, but the Gemara now, in its general term, is going to ask a question on the both of them. Bain Rabbi Yishmael, Bain Rabbi Akiva. In other words, when it uses the word Bain, what's it suggesting? It says, well, between the two of them, or about the two of them, whether it's one or the other, Avonav Hashem, my Avdebe, you could ask, what do they do with the last part of the second verse, which states that sin is upon it? Wants to know what you do with that part of the verse, because it's important to do something with every part of a verse. Licha d'tanya, and they'll explain that the expression is needed for what has been taught in the following brayta. Yachol afilu asa tshuva. It would be possible to say that the sinner is cut off even if he repents. Talmud lomar, avonav Hashem, therefore the Torah states, its sin is upon it, which indicates that lo amarti ela bizman she avonava. I don't say that the sinner's soul is cut off except when its sin is still upon it. In other words, if he didn't do tshuva. So I say the soul is cut off when the sin still remains upon the soul, but if the soul ultimately winds up making tshuva, then the soul doesn't get judged as being cut off from the people. Okay?
But the soul is not buried with the body. So there is already two places of the same person once they die. So
nobody's worried about what happens to the body in terms of soul life. And we're talking...
But when we decided...
We're talking about a person who will get rewarded in Olam Haba. You're talking about soul.
So why would
and the soul ultimately being cut off. Bodily resurrection as one concept of what may happen if you merit, your soul merits the world to come that we are proposing exists, perhaps in the bodily kind of way, ultimately gets you back to this life that we understand and know kind of reality, right? But just the same, thought existed about the next world, not in bodily form, that it was simply spiritual life, and that spiritual life could be in the great Beit Midrash with God, learning with the angels, if you will. So there's not that much concern about the exact body that you came from. Maybe at one point in one place in Jewish history, there was one thinker, I think it's Yosef Albo, who's writing about whether or not your particular body is going to be recharged.
I would like Arnold Schwarzenegger's body. That's
about my body. You might be a girl.
No. No, I have two sisters.
Okay.
I don't want to play.
Now, I wanted to look at that brayta in the Gemara and that exchange about the second part of that verse that was in question, because that'll get us back to the beginning of the packet, which is the Mishnah. Okay, now turn back to the Mishnah, and I could pass that along to Barry Bonnie. So the Mishnah at the beginning of our packet, Spark, can I put you one of these?
Okay. You'd be happy for me to have one. I'll take it.
Thank you for indulging me. If I can't give you a plane ticket to Israel, I might as well give you a Mishnah. Okay, so I want to look at the part of the Mishnah that we didn't look at the last time. And I want to think about it in terms of really what the message of the Mishnah is and whether a person deserves to be cut off or not to be cut off. First of all, we just saw in that brayta that we saw that there is a power of doing tshuva that ultimately winds up helping you redeem yourself from the excommunication that you might suffer. Right? That's where the Gemara ended off there. And we're going to take that as a place to kind of stop and say that is philosophically where the rabbis devised this notion that one who makes tshuva one moment in one's life ultimately receives the reward that awaits that person. By the way, there's a wonderful Levinas discussion of such a concept within Jewish circles. Right? If I really believe in the kind of interlocution that is at the core of human existence, dialogical reality, the responsibility I take facing the other in his classic sense of, you know, that other is acher in Hebrew, and acharayut is built on the notion that one human being sees another, and then ultimately by making this not even eye contact, this kind of contact, this notion of bridge to the other, that I ultimately have obligations towards that other individual and then all people around me, and I may either succeed very much so in the way that I interact and the way that I function within the greater community of humanity so that I take care of those who really do obligate me beyond the Kantian kind of ought to, that there is, especially in Judaism, the commandment that one must. And that if I don't succeed over a long stretch of time and I don't really live up to my obligations in such a regard, the question stands, can I turn to someone in this dialogue that I create and create the moment of tshuva that's reflected within such a Gemara passage? Am I A, open to it as an individual? B, am I prepared to try to arrive at such a place religiously, ethically, in order to return to that unique and disparate individual who in his or her own right needs from me this very relational two-way street, but knowing that we have limitations in terms of the way we communicate, what we actually say, make enough space that I arrive at a place where at least I should know what? That if they make tshuva, I am not the true judge. The true judge is the judge of judges, and that according to Gemara Sanhedrin, they ultimately are accepted into Olam Haba. And that as a motivating factor within my outlook philosophically as a Jew motivates me to be a different human being every time I approach another one.
You have to call Joe Schwartz and I'll explain why later.
Okay.
It's just a strange confluence.
Okay. So I find that to be really powerful and moving. The first time I encountered those ideas, I was at Givat Chaviva, which is I think I've mentioned at some point within the context of the training grounds where all stripes of Israeli society, including Arab, Israeli, Palestinian, Jewish, Ethiopian Jews, at that time less Soviet Jews than are in Israel today, we're all coming together to do these major kind of conferences of textual reading, multi-narrative readings of history, and trying to understand what it could be like if we face these things with some truth. There are, again, identifiable projects like this that go on all the time, and even when people come with very, very strong attachments to their own self-interest narratives, survival narratives, that's happening. Dialogically, I also encountered the idea when Rabbi Elliot Dorf would teach at the UJ, at the Ziegler School of Rabbinic Studies, where he talked a lot about the push beyond ought in Kantian ethics. And the notion that the idea of commandedness within modernity is very difficult for Jews, even in an ethical kind of way, let alone in a ritualistic Jewish way. And that there's a power here in the ritual helping one rehearse in some way for the moment of the interpersonal, the Ben Adam L'Chaveiro versus the Ben Adam L'Makom, Ben Adam L'Chaviro being a person and his or her fellow person, Ben Adam L'Makom being between a person and the Lord. So this is a deep area that I just thought before we actually do the end of the Mishnah and talk about individuals and their sins and why it seems they did not get a portion of the world to come, I wanted to bring to you something that might be more familiar, might not be at all, but that could be familiar because it's part of the Siddur. And it's been a part of the Siddur and the recital by Jews of our liturgy for ages, thousands of years. And that is a piece of Gemara from Kiddushin. Instead of throwing this on.
3, 4, 5. And then 3 this way.
So this is from the Gemara in Kiddushin. And you know, where does a person get credit, in other words, is the motivating factor for this moment. And it says here that Rava says the following. Rava Amar, I'm 39 B2. Okay? Rava Amar, Haimani, whose view does this right to follow? Just flow with me here. There was right there. Rabbi Akiva Hidamar, it follows the view of Rabbi Yaakov Hidamar, it follows the view of Rabbi Yaakov who says, Sachar mitzvah b'hai al maleka. The reward for fulfilling a mitzvah is not given in this world. D'tanya, for it's taught in a braita, Rabbi Yaakov Omer, Rabbi Yaakov says, Ein lecha kol mitzvah mitzvah shektuva b'torah shematan tzchara b'tzidah. Of all those commandments that are written in the Torah together with their reward, there's not a single one, she'ein techiyat ametim tluyaba, upon which the resurrection of the dead is not dependent. Ready? So, there's not a single mitzvah written in the Torah together with their reward. There's not one upon which the resurrection of the dead is not dependent. The reward for every mitzvah is given only in the world to come. Thus you have the contradiction between the Mishnah and the Braita presents no difficulty for the Braita follows the view of Rabbi Yaakov, whereas the Mishnah follows a dissenting Tanaitic view. What's the dissenting view, obviously? The Mishnah follows a dissenting Tanaitic view, meaning what? You can have some fulfillment of a mitzvah in this life. Right? So the argument here is, do we get the reward for mitzvot now? Or as they say in Jewish, at least Jewish professional circles, no mitzvah goes unpunished. Right? Sometimes this is the way that people ultimately experience such a life of being involved in the Jewish community. Rabbi Yaakov adduces a proof for the rule. B'chivud av v'em ketiv. In connection with the mitzvah of honoring one's father and mother, it's written, L'ma'an ya'arichun ya'mecha l'ma'an yitav lach. Honor your father and mother so that your days will be lengthened and that so that it will be good for you. Seemingly like what? The reward is? So you could say, what does it mean, lengthen the days? Does it mean this world? Does it mean the next world? It's a very philosophical question by way of this verse.
And will that be good for you?
Well, maybe your life will be like so long that you'll never go to the world.
Don't we assume that the next world has no end to it? Is there anything to lengthen in infinity?
Uh-huh. So that's a really good question, Bobby.
Very good question.
Do we really assume that this whole world is, ad infinitum? We didn't see necessarily that in the Gemara we read thus far. And philosophically, there are questions. Does it have an end?
We know this world has an end. So when I read this, I assume that this length of days that everyone would like to be healthy and to live longer and that this is the reward of this world.
Right.
It's fun to turn it around and everything, but these are people who lived every day and had diseases and died younger, and they wanted length of days. So it seems quite logical that that would be a reward.
I would say the Peshai, right, is the simple sense of the text.
It could
is that
simple, or it could be commonsensical. You know, yeah.
Well, we simple by way of
like it's naive, but
no, that's a technical term in our tradition.
I mean, I think it's almost degrading to say it's so Peshai, because it's not. It's something that just it makes sense in terms of the way people live, which in ways can be deeper than Peshai.
Okay.
Not just the surface.
Okay. Accepted that there's a deep sense of meaning in this birth attached to our hope for life in this life we know. Okay. But the questions of the rabbi sometimes do go like this. Well, if it's Yarich on Yomecha, if it's lengthening your days, then what's the Yitavlach? Won't that good be the next world? I need one for this world, I need one for the next world. We know that the rabbi's parlance works like that. Now, b'shiluach haken ketiv, and in connection with the mitzvah of sending a bird away from the nest before taking its young, it's written, l'ma'an yitavlach v'ha'arach tayamin, so that it will be good for you, and you will live long. Now, by the way, textually, it's kind of like a folk saying. Sometimes the Torah speaks, as the rabbis say, b'lashon b'nei adam, in the language of normal, everyday people. Right? Doesn't it sound like a very nice kind of thing about your life to say, you do that, you'll live long, it'll be good for you. Right? That's a beyond common sense. It's an absolute stamp of truth. Harei she'amar lo aviv, but what of the one whose father said to him, maybe you all know what's coming from Milton Steinberg's great work as a driven leaf, Ale la birav haveli gozalot. Climb up the tower and fetch me some young birds. Va'ala la birah, the son climbed up the tower. Veshilach et ha'em, drove the mother bird away. V'natal et habanim, and took the bird's offspring. Uvachazirato nafal umet. And on his way back, he fell and he died. Now this son fulfilled both the mitzvah of honoring his father and the mitzvah of driving away the mother bird. Heichan tovat yamav shel ze. Where is the good life that is promised him by the Torah? Veheichan arichut yamav shel ze. And where is the lengthening of days, the long life that's promised by the Torah? Ela l'man yitavlach, evidently the phrase so that it will be good with you, l'olam shekulo tov, refers to the world that is entirely good, that is the world to come. U'l'man yarichon yamecha, and the phrase so that your life will be long, l'olam shekulo aroch, refers to the world that is entirely long, the world to come. So if we read before and we felt as powerfully about the Torah's message as we expressed, how is it, why is it, that the Gemara tells this story then and interprets both phrases as being about the world to come? First of all, it's no mystery that sometimes people do take solace, whatever solace they can find individually, and not thrust upon them by another person, I would say, as a rule for how this works. They find solace in thinking about their child going off to a next world, being close to God, being and one who inherits that world of eternity where there is no pain, particularly about the pain. Right? there's also the sense in here of challenging the Torah's Peshat. And we won't use simple, Bobby. We'll use something more complex, as you suggested. There is a challenge to our faith that sometimes it's very difficult to see. The Torah promises one way, and life comes out a completely different alternative way. The idea of an Olam Haba at all, then, a world to come, stands spiritually, philosophically, as a certain type of hope that this life and the experience of this life, the pain and the suffering of this life, cannot be the only life and the only experience we have in soul form, let alone any thought about bodily. And that, I think, is why they're immediately able to say about both in a hermeneutical way. In other words, the textual method here is to reinterpret the verses of Torah that promise the length of days and promise the goodness of life into an indication that a person will indeed inherit a world that is entirely good. Kulo, right? Kulo tov. Comments to this point?
Is there any other places in the Talmud or in the Torah that there is a direct relation between a mitzvah and reward, or no mitzvah and punishment, and the length of time between one and another?
Length of time in terms of measure? Not exactly.
Because here it's immediate.
Yeah.
He made a mitzvah and he was punished.
I mean, this is a unique moment of finding verses that promise these particular things.
Because in this case, it's immediate. So I wonder if there is, in any other part of the Bible or in the Talmud,
the basic setup of inheriting the land itself as a direct reward for ethical behavior is really a part of the entire project of the inheritance of the land. Otherwise, if you're not, right, it will spit you out. It will literally expel you.
Every day in Siddur we read about the rains will come, you'll have good...
Right.
You didn't work for Jacob.
I'm just saying that...
The second paragraph of the Shema is the classic reward punishment.
Exactly.
Locus. And that, the rain in their seasons and tuvuah, produce, as being a reward for one's performance of mitzvot, is for sure.
They didn't work for those people. That's the reason they went to Egypt. They were good Jews. They were praying. Jacob was...
It's not like a magic incantation. That was in some ways the difference in our ancient culture between others who might have had some more magical beliefs, that their incantations, their use of God's names, and their offerings to please gods, in terms of satiating them, in a way that we think about ourselves satiated with food, they might have thought some of that. We strove not to entirely, though we were part of a great culture of, if you will, Canaanite peoples and definitely had our understandings. What's that?
And sacrifices.
All right. I mean, sacrifices, what I'm mentioning about them within what I'm saying now is that at least the kind of move away from sacrifices that were about satiating deities and putting oneself on the altar in order to expiate sin is a little bit of the thinking about sacrifice that differentiated the ancient Israelite sacrificial system. And it can be argued both ways that there may not have been such a level of sophistication in the approach to the sacrificial worship that did go on in ancient temple culture. Or we could see from the notion of the literary record and the Torah's reporting of it and the way we did ultimately devise the system that the kind of feelings associated with the sacrifices and the concepts in Vayikra, guilt, sin, gratitude, were really all very human at their core, and allowed us, through this kind of worship that did go on in the ancient world, to move away from the idolatrous system of sacrifice. Now, the prophets internally critiqued our ability to gather that much intentionality. We read that on the high holidays, right? You emptied your pockets, you brought your sacrifice, and you had no real intentionality of truly returning to me. Your lips moved, you said nothing.
I think the great mystery of Jewish continuity occurred after the destruction of the first temple, because at that point we didn't do what everyone else did, which was just to say, obviously our God wasn't able to protect us, and therefore these other gods must be more powerful. Now, that's what happened over and over and over again, as each religion disappeared and each civilization disappeared and adopted that view. So the great mystery to me of Jewish continuity is at that moment, and why the decision was made, in fact, to say we got what we deserved, and in fact it's clear that we did a lot of bad things, and therefore this was our just reward for doing those bad things. And so I've always interpreted that as a very remarkable thing, but really driven by a paradox, and that is the ability to compel God to act favorably by righteous deeds. So that you take away God's free will by being so good that God has no choice but to favor you. And that's the secret of how you actually live within that religious framework.
I see this discussion as being rooted almost in the opposite. To me, this is all based in the issue of theodicy. It's from a slightly different slant, but I feel that they're grappling with how do we deal with the fact that righteous people suffer in this world, and that that's where this notion of wanting to provide the olam haba helps cope with the suffering that people have here.
Or the next world is in a certain way that kind of world you'll never suffer in. I think that it's what's fascinating is that I think Professor Yerushalmi, in the classic book on Jewish history and the survival of the people and the way we became a people of history, touches a little bit on what you're saying, Barry, in the sense that I think what he's proposing in his work is that the minute we saw God's actions as being present in history, and that our just reward, or it's interesting you use just reward because I would have thought to say just dessert, that we got what we deserved, and it was delivered on the platter of history, or through the peoples who attacked us and took our home and didn't allow us to live that system of doing by our own free will the kind of living that God commanded, and that is through the mitzvot, through the corpus of law that was so important, right? And if you didn't read Ben Summers' his article of a couple years ago that appeared on Torah.org, even if you go to biblical criticism and you believe in J-E-P-N-D for a minute, or you believe God revealed several strands within Torah to engage us in our rational, a love of the rational. But however you want to explain the capital A author or the notion that there are strands to identify. Right? For all the strands of Torah that you could identify using a name like Hashem, Adonai, or Elohim, or the priests, or what have you, every one of them was focused on the law. Every one of them focused on a life through law, a covenantal agreement of a people with God. And that free will was never repressed. And that the sacrifice is actually a test to free will. Because even though I would figure that living a life of law might just lead to no place, because the evildoers in this life seem to get their reward, but the goodniks, the people who follow the law, don't seem to get everything that's coming to them in terms of a just reward. Their dessert is not served, and it's not sweet. That ultimately, the sacrificial system allows me to come back to my Lord, my God, put the sacrifice on the altar, say, God, this is in place of me. I'm a human being with a free will. I know that there must be greater reward than this. Life itself is the great reward you give me. Free will is the great mindset, the great way that I can approach this world. And everybody ultimately dies. Why shouldn't I make my life more reflective of the law, the covenant that you ultimately entrusted me with as a partner? So that I feel is at the core of the whole experience of the Jewish people.
If we go back to the portion after the Shema, the logic is absolutely, to me, compelling. If you do this, you're going to have rains in your season, which means that I can compel God by my behavior, which means that I feel a sense of power by virtue of the exercise of my free will in the service of Messiah.
See, I don't think it's compulsion of God. I think it's living up to your end of the covenantal agreement that was made, which is very, I think, very different. But I could see where the power trip would happen.
I understand what you're saying, but bear me out, or hear me out just a little bit more. I'm saying, why did it go the way it went? And I'm saying psychologically, my intuition, and that's all I have, is the power of the way I'm presenting it. And I'm not necessarily saying it represents my view.
I know, I hear.
But the power of that equation, especially for people who feel powerless, given that what happened to them.
Yeah.
I think is probably what we're sustaining.
Nice. That I could see where that would be really sustaining. Really sustaining.
But what about for those in the group who had been good all along?
Yeah, so
I think it's rather disappointing for them as opposed to sustaining.
Well, I think what we're seeing here is the working out of that. As you said it.
Yeah.
Exactly as you said it. Because they have to confront the inconsistencies with the simple interpretation, and I think this is an attempt to deal with that. But I think it's reflecting that underlying view that, in fact, there will be a reward if your behavior follows the mitzvah.
Henry?
I've been trying to remember who the rabbi was. You may have read it here. Rabbi Akiva, who, when he was told he wasn't going to make it to the world to come, was ecstatic, because then when he was performing a mitzvah, it was for the pure pleasure of performing it and doing something for the honor of God. And I found that very moving, and it always seemed to me that if we want a world in which there's immediate or even not immediate gratification through a reward for having done something, we're just a bunch of hamsters who You know, get a piece of candy for having done something good. That you're bound to be disappointed at some point by the expectation that by doing something you're going to get rewarded for that something, and that really the rains in the season can only be looked at as metaphoric, and that you really should. I really do believe that people who have done something good come away with something higher than somebody who doesn't, and that the bad things happen in good days. It's up there. It probably is a satanic whatever up there who's whispering in God's ear, let me test these people by having something happen to them to see if really they're really achieving this pleasure and they're really not expecting something. Mm. But I think we're just bound for, you know, being unhappy if you have that expectation. Mm. That's my view. Mm.
So I'm gonna be very basic. So we learned in Sitter class recently that a child who is willing to work hard in class because the child is promised honey, a fig, or a nut, right? There were the three ranges, and I forgot the hierarchy, but there was within what we were studying. But that's fine, because that's, quote-unquote, childlike. But I'm going to suggest to you that that's all of us, and it's all of us for our whole adult lives, too. And I think that that is a profound acknowledgement of the rabbis to understand that, and that for us to be able to transcend that is for very few, because most of us still stay, however fancy we get, with, I'm very happy to get my nut, my fig, or my honey. So that's one element. And then the other element is, in the conversation that was sort of like on this end of the table for a while, I mean, I've done readings now with Mesopotamian divination, and so it just seems to me that these people were working very hard to make sense of the world. And they look for signs to help them. And they couldn't explain why this happened and that happened. And I think we see that somewhat here, too, with the praying for the rain, especially. Even though we've attributed it to a divine, one divine intervention, it has a long leg, long history to it. It's not unique to Jews at all. It goes way back when, because that's what they all needed. They needed water. So I don't see it as a blessing of good behavior or not behavior. I see it as an acknowledgement of fundamental to continue, in fact, to continue life, you had to have water. So is that the world to come because it's a beautiful world where you have water? That's maybe their image. Hmm. But I guess I have the hard part about the connection with behavior. Mm-hmm. That we have any... We want something for what we do.
So, I just want to point out a couple of things. First of all, I purposefully had us read the back of the packet because I was thinking that we might just get to this question. Is what we do really, do we store up any kind of merit before the Lord? Do we get our fig? Do we get our honey? Are we working towards that? Even with theodicy in the world and all the crazy things, can one instant of such a thing work for us, a la the tshuva that we read about in Sanhedrin? Or do we store up good things from all the times that we've done goodness? Whether or not anybody recognizes it or not, my God recognize it. And, by the way, just before we turn and flip the page, I love the next line of the Gemara. Because the Gemara... No. I'm still here. I'm still here. Maybe it never happened.
So, like you couldn't have bestowed care.
All this, that's right. But maybe, Vadilma love Hachi Hava. Maybe this never happened. You know, the story pulls you into this, you know, crazy place of how could this happen to this child, and listen to the conversation that it created.
They can't really believe it. It's so hard to believe.
They can't believe it.
And they don't want to accept it.
They don't want to accept it. And they don't. And they can't understand it. And in that sense, you know, they don't want to accept it. They can't understand it. That even with measuring sticks that they could understand, they don't. Flip over now to where it says Mishnah and Gemara on the English sheet that you're holding. Because the beginning, this Mishnah, listen to the Mishnah. Kol ha'osei mitzvah achat. Whoever performs one mitzvah, metivin lo, is rewarded with good. Umarichin lo yamav. His life is lengthened. Now, that's pretty clear. But the first time I ever looked at this Mishnah with a teacher of mine, he said the following. In Chavruta, you tell me now two different meanings for metivin lo, is rewarded with good, umarichin lo yamav, and the days are lengthened. What two things are we talking about? What does it mean to have a reward when you perform a mitzvah in this life, and what does it mean to have lengthened days? What's that?
I'm trying to think of two meanings of length of days. Maybe each day is longer, and then, or your whole life. I mean, is it possible to have each day seem longer,
mm-hmm.
and your whole life seem longer?
How do you enjoy it more?
Maybe the days feel like more because they're so
good.
Enjoyable.
Feel like more. So this was on both the emotional and kind of temporal level. So temporally, longer, and you deepen it. You deepen that feeling. You have that sense that life is good. And then, so what's good if already longer means that it's kind of longer and deeper? The good is that the world becomes more complete and whole, because anytime you see good in text, on the hypertext level, where do you go? You go back to the story of creation, and you hear God saying, Kitzov. That's a good world. That's a good world where people do mitzvot. Now what else do you get? V'nochelet ha'aretz, and he inherits the world. Now, if you look at the note, Rashi says, that's a reference to the world to come. V'chol she'eno osei mitzvah achat, whoever does not perform one mitzvah, ein metivin lo, is not rewarded with good, v'ein ma'arichin lo yamav, his life is not lengthened, v'eino nochelet ha'aretz, and he doesn't inherit the world. What if the world didn't mean the second world, the world to come? What if it meant ha'aretz? Could say, wait a minute, can't I understand it, that it means the land of Israel? Why are they not interested so much in that it's always the land of Israel? Back to our observation that this is a diaspora project. At some point, the commentary on the Talmud is coming from Babylonia, the ancient Babel. The Rashi is making commentary in France. I think there's a simple explanation sometimes to when certain passages are understood, but then there's, of course, the internal passage in the Gemara that says what they really mean is the world to come. But it's still a project of the diaspora and a project of the rabbis philosophically dealing with suffering and dealing with the fact maybe a mitzvah should have a reward.
But this was written in Jerusalem.
The Mishnah is an oral tradition that may indeed have been Israel-based. It may have indeed been from traditions in Egypt, by the way, where you still had an ancient Jewish community. It may have had some diaspora rabbis in connection with those in Jerusalem. We know that the network of Jewish community and teachers was much more expansive than we think. So,
I just want to clarify, you say inherit the world could mean the land of Israel, that gets access to the land of Israel. Okay. So the world means Eretz rather than Allah.
But we didn't say that in front of what happened this week.
Uraminhu. But contrast our Mishnah with the following Mishnah. Right? We're going to bring a Mishnah from Peah. Elu divarim. These are the precepts. She'adam ochel perotehen ba'olam hazeh. A person enjoys in this world. Enjoys whose fruits a person enjoys in this world. V'hakeren kayemet lo la'olam haba. But the principle remains intact for him in the world to come. So everything I do that's good, Although what Henry said, I not only enjoy the fruit of that labor in this world, but I store up capital in the world to come. Elu hen, they are as follows. Kibud av ve'en, respect of one's mother and father. U'gimilut chasadim, bestowing kindness. V'hachnasat orchim, receiving visitors. V'havaat shalom ben adam l'chavero, making peace between one person and another. The Talmud Torah keneged kulam, and studying Torah is equal to them all, of course, because we're dealing with the Chachamim. And the fact that it does bring you through the gateways of reflecting and refining life through the filter of Torah. Now, this is a very, you know, I would say, famous Braita, not only because it's in Peah, and by the way, the Peah, tractate Peah, does not include Hachnasat Orchim, which is receiving visitors. But we include the Kedushin version within our Sidur and not the Peah version. Now, this is a Sidur that is called Sidur Mifurash. It has... Okay. Is there something?
No, I didn't know the word Peah. So it's just
a. Oh, Peah.
Like Peah, like corners.
Like Peah, like corners, right?
So glean.
Like leaving the corners of the field. Mishnah Peah is in the tractate Seeds. Okay, so in this Sidur, there's a small kind of synopsis of larger commentaries on passages that are in the Sidur, and so it says these are the precepts that don't have any measure. And then you get to the ones that say, these are the ones that you enjoy the fruit in this world and the capital stored up here in the world to come, which is what we just read in the Talmud and Kiddushin. So you see this in the morning after the blessing of Torah study. So you're using these as passages to remind you that you should do good and you're going to get good on top of the good. What does... Right. What does kibud av ve'em really mean?
Yes.
Respecting the parents.
That's in the Talmud, I tell you.
Now, in the Talmud and Kiddushin, it says that you owe them food and you owe them some money and you have to not sit in the father's place.
Right.
And if they ask you to do something crazy like throw a wallet out to the sea even when they're senile, then you throw the wallet. By the way, there's one commentary I once found that said you could take the money out of the wallet and then throw the wallet. But so the reality is that I always thought about some people in the morning saying this who might not have had the greatest relationship with their parents. So then what do I do? Like, am I automatically faced with the kind of crisis that brings up? Some people have this wonderful, powerful relationship, and some people have less than. And beyond that, some people really do have abusive parents. I found a perush that I really like to share with people who will say to me that it's really difficult, and I think in many ways this is what mysticism has brought to us in terms of a spiritual language for our people. It's allowed us sometimes to leave the simple sense or the straightforward, what translation it is. I'm going to now rethink the word using simple, Bobby. You know, when we say, that's used by scholars too. What are we going to do with that shot?
It's hard to remake this.
I'm going to think about that one. Anyway, kibud avem, what does it mean? So first of all, when you're dealing with mystical literature, what is the Abba and the Ima? Chochma and Bina. Wisdom and understanding in terms of the spherotic chart. There are 10 different aspects of divine reality that flow down into the world. That we, how we know God, God's presence can be put into these 10 different spherot. Sometimes they're structured like one's up here, two here, three here, four, five, six, seven. Yeah, the diagram. There are many different diagrams of spherot, by the way. One is inside the other, 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 until you get either to the top one or the bottom one in this kind of chart, the tree of life. Anyway, when you think about Kibud Av V'Em, one mystical source will tell you, as long as you're constantly someone striving in your adult life to be someone who's constantly pursuing wisdom and understanding and study, you're honoring your father and mother who bore you into the world to become the most intelligent human soul you can, and then bring that kind of divine light to the world through your personal understandings and your intellect. This Perush says that it's really harachat ha-havaya, the deep appreciation of the kind of existence that God created in the world. That we are all, ultimately, who? Children of the first parents ever, in a certain way. That Adam v'Chava stand as this model. That we can see ourselves as at least coming from parents, and that there's this structural reality of life that parents beget children, children marry, beget other children. Today's world, think about the complexity of all those machinations of how children are being born into the world, and all that complex reality for Rav Kook, who's writing this Sidur, at the cusp of modernity, and knowing that Havaya is changing, the experience of being and beingness is changing. He says, if you could see this as a sense that physical reality has a real purpose, but that you shouldn't reduce it to just physical reality. You should see kedei shelo lachshich et haziv ha'olam mikorot ha'netzach. That you shouldn't see it as ever disguising the kind of ever-present spark of light, which is a reference back to the ultimate myth of Zoharic mysticism, which when God pulled out of space, there was an infusion of a divine light brighter than anyone could ever imagine that then filled the space and then ultimately created all kinds of matter and reality, right? And that is what you're recognizing, that the understanding and the intellect makes space for the divine shefa, the divine effluence, and the divine light that is called the Ziv HaNetzach here, which is a poetic term that I believe only I've only seen in Rav Kook, which is beautiful poetry about how you constantly recognize how divine this whole plan is. So that to me is a really interesting way to say that you can take this whole commandment of Avanima and appreciate creation. Of course, it's not between a person and his fellow, which frankly the rest of the list really is about a person and other human beings. So it takes it outside of the nature of the passage, but it is a powerful one nonetheless, and other mystical commentaries on the Siddur take them the same direction. They leave the simple sense there, but they bring it to a different mystical sense as well at the same time, and it creates a vocabulary of deep appreciation for moving beyond material worlds and seeing God's presence in the world. And then the passage goes, Gimilut Chasadim, the commentary says, She'adam oseh chesed im chavero bli kesef. That it's not a monetary kind of thing, because money always has a measure, but that you ultimately go through and you do and bestow kindness. And v'hashkamat beit hamidrash shacharit v'aravit, and that you come to the synagogue and you come to the house of learning, you take it upon yourself to bring people to your home, leveito, vikor cholim, you visit the sick, with hachnasat kala, what's it mean to enter a bride, shimisayeya, lindodnita ulatachshitea. So you bring her clothing, you bring her jewelry, shetuchal likanes lechupa mefuratet.
You help create the nidunia.
You help create what is
the
dowry and or interpreted to be the gifts that a bride would need in order to make the wedding day beautiful and the home beautiful. Lilavodata mate. You bring the mate, you go to the funeral service and you go to the kever and you participate in the burial. The iyun tefila, that you have intentionality within your prayer to find God and to find meaning within it. Talmud Torah, that you learn Torah and that you make that a habit. And why is it that Keneged Kulam, why is it equal to them all?
It includes them all.
Ki alimud mevi liyadei ma'asei, according to this commentary, that learning brings you to the act of doing.
Better than Shef Adasa. I like you.
Right. Better than the principle of Ron is reminding me, sit and do nothing. Which is in the Talmud sometimes.
Which is to all of what you just said.
Well, it could be, except that you don't get the extra amount of you know, kind of capital.
So why do we say the good dayan?
Why do we say that? I don't say that.
I don't think it came from the
joke. I don't say that.
No, but you have another authority.
I know what it means. I know exactly. And that's what it
means. It was Billy Joel who said it. I don't know.
No, it's because if you die young, that's the only way you think of the person for the rest of your thinking. So it's not that the person had any maturity. It's just that's how he was encapsulated. It's like a time machine.
I just say one comment, which is that, you know, the Kabbalistic thing is very interesting intellectually, and it's another dimension. But when you read this whole list of very specific things, these are the things that keep society and keep the disenfranchised and the family and all of the things keep us together and keep us going. And I would say maybe one of the hardest things to do to honor one's mother and father and keep them in old age despite all of the history and things that go on. So whereas it may be wonderful to think about this conceptually, I do think that practicality of in this world when people are old and it is very difficult, giving them honor despite the fact that some of them really go off a tangent and are not the kind of people they ever were, or worse than the people that they ever were, that deserves the Olam Haba and things in this world. So it may be interesting to think about Shekhinah and all of that, but I don't think it lets you off the hook.
The difference is that in that long list, there should probably be ample opportunity for you to do all those things in your community. However, maybe you're young and your parents are gone. So the question is, how can I do this anymore? So there's that one interpretation that allows you still to feel that you're fulfilling that.
Well, there's all the Yisro parts. There's all the memorialization and things afterwards.
That's only once a year. Here it comes once a year.
Things to do in their honor.
It doesn't undo your merit for attending to your parents if they're still alive, nor does it undo your responsibility to do
that's
so.
That's an interesting point to keep it continuing.
To me, the interesting thing is it's all about community. It's not about individual to God. It's all about a social community and social responsibility. And I think that if you're an isolated community removed from your native environment,
mm-hmm.
it's easy to understand why sustaining that community in isolation is a very, very imperative.
Yeah, definitely.
That whole communal aspect is something that we certainly as Americans have no grasp for on our own until we study it. But I think I'm only raising this because you raised the same paragraph with I read that very communally too. I think it's speaking a lot about not just if we observe the commandments, which may be what we call ritualistic, but all of the other ones too, that if we do everything that can be done to maintain a cohesive society and a society which is ecologically aware and everything else, that a lot of those things we will have. So I think that also is I always read that community.
Right. So what I want to do now is go back to the end of our Mishnah, come back to the packet that is says chapter 11 on the front. So we learned through most of this Mishnah. We're now informed by some of the philosophical underpinnings. We noted just now that it is about the communal responsibility between persons and their fellows. We say that the greatest rewards will come, and we store up goodness. We get some reward for goodness, at least according to the Mishnah. And we yet have a few individuals who are by name singled out at the end of this first Mishnah in this Perek, where we're talking about all this Olam Haba, who are cut off. And seems a little out of character to begin with, because we like to be generous, especially if you go by the fact that what person could make tshuva at any moment and then receive the reward. But I want to now go back and explore what's going on here at the end of this mission. So flip the page on the packet with our Mishnah and go to the end of the Mishnah, where the Mishnah now lists specific historical individuals. It's on 90A7. Okay, so 90A7. Okay, so it says, the Mishnah now lists specific historical individuals who forfeited their share in the world to come. They forfeited them. It's an interesting way to put it in terms of the commentary of the Ari Scroll Sidur. Shlosha melachim v'arba'a hedyotot ein lahem chalek l'olam haba. Three kings and four citizens, or four commoners, have no share in the world to come. Shlosha melachim, Yerovam, Achav, and Menashe. Three kings are Yerovam, Achav, and Menashe. And Rabbi Yehuda says, Menashe yesh lo chelek l'olam haba. But Menashe has a portion in the world to come. Shenemar, Vayitpalel elav, Vayishma techinato, Vayishivehu Yerushalayim lemalchuto. As it stated, and he prayed to God, and God allowed God's self to be entreated and heard Menashe's plea, and then God returned him to Jerusalem, to his kingdom. Amrulo, the sages said to Rabbi Yehuda, Lemalchuto eshivo. From this verse, we infer that that refers to his kingdom. Below l'chay olam haba heshivo, but not to the olam haba, not to the world to come. The arba'a hedyotot Bil'am v'doeg v'achitofel v'gechazi. The four commoners are as follows: Bil'am, Doeg, Achitofel, and Gechazi. Now, right. Here's what we're going to do. We're going to look now at these kings for a second. Yerovam. Read the note with me. Yerovam revolted against the sovereignty of Rehavam, the son of King Solomon, and then led the 10 tribes in a break from the kingdom of the house of David. Fearing that if his subjects would go to the temple in Jerusalem to offer sacrifices to God on the three festivals, they would gradually resume their loyalty to the house of David, he established what? Two golden calves within his kingdom for his people to serve, and thus led them to idolatry. So let's open the Tanakh here to 1 Kings 12. Let's read it from the inside here. Now Rehoboam sent he got word that Yerovam is rebelling, and he musters all the house of Judah and the tribe of Benjamin, 180,000 picked warriors, to fight against the house of Israel in order to restore the kingship of Rehoboam, son of Solomon. But the word of God came to Shemaiah, the man of God, saying to the king Rehoboam, son of Solomon of Judah, and to all the house of Judah and Benjamin and the rest of the people, thus said the Lord, you shall not set out to make war on your kinsmen, the Israelites. Let every man return to his home, for this thing has been brought about by me. Back to the notion of the God who gives them what they deserve. They heeded the word of the Lord and turned back in accordance with the word of the Lord. An instance where, by the way, in rhetorical parlance, one can take from the Tanakh a passage that says it is not time to make war on fellow Jews. Right? Now, Yerovam fortified Shechem in the hill country of Ephraim and resided there. He moved out from there and fortified Penuel. Yerovam said to himself, now the kingdom may well return to the house of David. If these people still go up to offer sacrifices at the house of the Lord in Jerusalem, the heart of these people will turn back to their master. They'll kill me and go back to King Rehoboam of Judah. So the king took counsel and made two golden calves. Vayivat hamelech vayashne egle zahav. He said to the people, you've been going up to Jerusalem long enough. This is your God, O Israel, who brought you up from the land of Egypt. He set up one in Bethel and placed the other in Dan. That proved to be a cause of guilt for the people who went to worship the calf at Bethel and one at Dan. He also made cult places and appointed priests from the ranks of the people who were not of Levite descent. He stationed at Bethel the priests of the shrines that he had appointed to sacrifice to the calves that he had made, and Yerovam established a festival on the 15th day of the 8th month, an imitation of the festival in Judah. He established one at Bethel and ascended the altar there. On the 15th day of the 8th month, the month of which he had contrived of his own mind to establish a festival for the Israelites, Yerovam ascended the altar that he had made in Bethel. No portion. No argument. Ahav. We'll say about Ahab, he was the king of the 10 tribes, together with his wicked wife Jezebel, introduced Baal idolatry to Israel. If you were in Shul the other day, you heard. That was the bringing of all these prophets of Baal. And who's the one fighting?
Phoenicians.
Eliyahu, there is a matter of some Phoenician connection in the story, because ultimately he brings in who to his kingdom? He's kind of saying to the Phoenicians, and he's saying to the local Canaanites, by bringing in the prophets of Baal, right, that we want to be allies with you.
Right.
And he's into what's called in the ancient world syncretism. This kind of notion that all gods can live here together, and we'll take care of having everybody's prophets represented. God of Israel does not accept this. Elijah the prophet becomes the one to help completely challenge the prophets of Baal, and it's the famous notion of Elijah ridding the land. The final one, though, Menashe, is the interesting one, because that's the one where there's a machloket within the Mishnah itself.
What is machloket?
Machloket is the word that we say meaning a disagreement. Everybody has their chelek in an argument, their part in an argument, therefore the word machloket comes about. Lichalek, in this case, means you take your part, I'll take my part. Let's talk about it. Could be. Depending on how you describe a machloket, there are those who say it's discussion, and there are those who say, we were just in Kedushin, so I'll mention what it says in Kedushin. You start out as oyvim bashar, enemies at the gate, but then all the time what you're doing is you're coming out as ohave Torah, loyal subjects and lovers of Torah. Okay, Menashe. So Menashe, internally already, there's an argument, Shenemar. Now what's interesting about the Mishnah again here, in my sense of how Mishnah reads sometimes, there's a claim in the Mishnah that Menashe does not have, or he's forfeited, his portion in the world to come. But then there's a response. It's like we can't wait for the Gemara to have this response. We have to stay right in the Mishnah. Menashe doesn't get the world to come. Wait a minute! I have a verse that says something different. Again, this is my sense that sometimes Mishnah is working a little bit like Talmud without any scaffolding vocabulary of the stama'e clayer. It's a rhetorical process there. And they're throwing the verse against the teaching, just like the verse would be used in standard Talmudic parlance. Okay, so the verse happens about Menashe. So Menashe, the son of the righteous king Chizkiyahu, king of Judah, was an idolatrous king who's compared to, by scripture, to Ahab. Let's go to 2 Kings 21 now. Just an advertisement for the books of Kings. If you have not looked at the books of Kings in a while, or you've not really gone through the books of Kings, fantastic, fantastic books. Just fantastic. Okay, that was the advertisement moment. 21, chapter 21. Menashe was 12 years old when he became king. He reigned 55 years in Jerusalem. His mother's name was Hephzibah. Hephzibah. Okay.
We have Hephzibah from Egypt.
Okay. You never know what kind of allegiances are noted in names. And using others' names, not the person themselves, was a way to actually kind of nod and say, we're with you culturally. Okay. He did what was displeasing to the Lord, following the abhorrent practices of the nations that the Lord had dispossessed before the Israelites. He rebuilt the shrines that his father Chizkiyahu had destroyed. He erected altars for Baal and made a sacred post. Right? That sacred post, again. The Asherah, which is a god in and of itself. It's not just a post upon which to put an offering. As King Ahab of Israel had done. He bowed down to all the hosts of heaven and worshipped them. And he built altars for them in the house of the Lord, of which the Lord had said, I will establish my name in Jerusalem. He built altars for all the hosts of heaven in the two courts of the house of the Lord. He consigned his son to the fire. And he practiced soothsaying and divination and consulted ghosts and familiar spirits. He did much that was displeasing to the Lord to vex him. The sculptured image of Asherah that he placed in the house concerning which the Lord had said to David and to his son Solomon, in this house and in Jerusalem which I chose out of all the tribes of Israel, I will establish my name forever. Important there, the pasuk says my name forever, meaning that what? We were people who knew God by name and not by image. And I will not again cause the feet of Israel to wander from the land that I gave to their fathers, if they will but faithfully observe all that I have commanded them, all the teachings with which my servant Moses charged them. But they did not obey, and Menashe led them astray to do greater evil than the nations that the Lord had destroyed before the Israelites. Therefore the Lord spoke through his servants, the prophets. Because King Menashe of Judah had done these abhorrent things, he has outdone in wickedness all that the Amorites did before his time. And because he led Judah to sin with his fetishes, assuredly, thus said the Lord, the God of Israel, I am going to bring such a disaster on Jerusalem and Judah that both ears of everyone who hears it will tingle. I will apply to Jerusalem. Seems like we need a stronger word than tingle.
Yeah.
I will apply to Jerusalem the measuring line of Samaria and the weights of the house of Ahab, and I will wipe Jerusalem clean as one wipes a dish and turns it upside down. And I will cast off the remnant of my own people and deliver them into the hands of their enemies. They shall be plunder and prey to all their enemies because they have done what is displeasing to me and have been vexing me from the day that their fathers came out of Egypt to this day. Moreover, Menashe put so many innocent persons to death that he filled Jerusalem with blood from end to end, besides the sin he committed in causing Judah to do what was displeasing to the Lord. The other events of Menashe's reign and all his actions and the sins he committed are recorded in the annals of the kings of Judah. Menashe slept with his fathers and was buried in the garden of his place, in the garden of Uzzah, and his son Amon succeeded him as king. Now, in that passage, right, let's look. Is that the Shnei Amar? The verse that says, and he prayed to him, and God allowed himself to be entreated, and heard his plea, and returned him to Jerusalem to his kingdom?
No,
because that is not in the book of Kings. That is in the book of Chronicles. What is the book of Chronicles? Advertising moment. The Book of Chronicles are incredible. If you have not, if you have not looked at the books of Chronicles, these books are incredible. Because these books, first of all, on a scholarly level, are the books that advertise King David's prominence among all of the lines of the house of Israel, and want to make right so many cases, so much of what people's religious lives are about, and shows how they make tshuva. So let's look together. 2 Chronicles 33:13. Amazing part of the Bible. A great summary of so much that went on, but with additions. So we have to understand what's additional and what's not. So 2 Chronicles 33:13. The Lord spoke to Manasseh, I'll start from verse 10. The Lord spoke to Manasseh and his people, but they would not pay heed. So the Lord brought against them the officers of the army of the king of Assyria, who took Manasseh captive in manacles, bound him in fetters, and led him off to Babylon. In his distress, he entreated the Lord his God and humbled himself greatly before the God of his fathers. He prayed to him, and he granted his prayer, heard his plea, and returned him to Jerusalem, to his kingdom. Then Manasseh knew that the Lord alone was God. That is like our Brita that we saw in Kiddushin. But doesn't it leave space for me to make tshuva if I've done none of these other great precepts and had capital stored up for me? Can't I, in the moment of my severe distress, even after my life of crookedness and wayward means and bloodletting, make this tshuva? So Chronicles seems to say, in a certain sense, I could even get there according to what the Lord has in store for me.
Isn't it the jailhouse conversion?
Yeah.
Yeah, but the problem is, the problem is, you couldn't have society that would. So Kings needs to be kept pure. And Chronicles needs to be a religious instruction book to say that if a person does turn around seemingly in this life, the same way that such a story was told about the kid who went up on the ladder and the king who and the kid who fell and was doing a mitzvah of kibud av, of respecting his father, and shiluah haken, of sending the mother bird away before he took the little chicks, and yet he paid with his life, right? That you think this guy is restored and the evil are not getting their just desert, maybe he'll be rewarded for this moment. According to the Brita, one method is to say, one look at it is to say, he does get the extended reward of Olam Haba. Another one says, but what? In a different place, in the parlance of the Gemara speaking about it, maybe he doesn't. Maybe he doesn't. But perhaps if I can show some evildoer, so evil in his ways, is able to say the kind of prayers of tshuva that would be accepted by the Lord come the end of the entire Tanakh project, if you will, that he would be accepted by God, maybe anybody could.
But it also says he, the next 33 years, he attempted to prepare. And part of
right.
The tshuva is not repeating it.
Exactly. Maybe anybody could. And here, the book shows him as being a truly repentant soul in Israel, versus the kind of evildoer, complete evildoer he was over there. And so you have a certain sense that Manasseh, what is his reward? Perhaps it's only the reward of this life, because he does continue to entreat God as the final point of the day, as the footnote's going to say if you read through it all the way. But we have to decide very deeply whether someone truly in making tshuva actually gets Olam Haba or not. Because their reward could be this life, and maybe not the next world. And the rabbis will say that in Sanhedrin, to say, some people will get their reward now. But trust me, they got no Keren Kayemet La Olam Haba. They got no stored up capital for the next. And therefore, they really are cut off. And thus the machloket, the argument, the conversation, the conversation in our Mishnah.
Okay, so next week there's no problem, because there's a shaman's check the dinner for Henry.
Thank you.
And then the week after is like, we'll have a class, right? Because for us in the weekend. And then how many